Who are you? The proud Lord said that I must bow so low. Only a cat of a different coat, that's all the truth I know. In a coat of gold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And my name is Miles McNutt, and I've also read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, which means we get to have some fun.
Yeah, we do. And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. This is the part of the introduction where Dave usually gives some spoiler rules. But as you might have noticed, Dave isn't here this week, and that's because this is a very special spoiler version of A Cast of Kings. We're talking book spoilers. We're talking show spoilers. This episode has everything you don't want to hear if you hate spoilers. So if you don't want to be spoiled by talk of future books or the upcoming seasons, then I suggest you turn off this episode, go outside, have a walk. We warned you a lot and loudly. So without further ado, we're going to get into talking about spoilers in anticipation of episode 9 of season 3 of Game of Thrones. So first, we're going to start off by Miles writes a good deal about television in general and specifically about Game of Thrones. And I want to get your overall sort of impressions of the season, and also to talk to you a bit about whether or not you feel like it's fruitful as a critic to compare the show to the book so much, or whether it's better to just take it as a show on its own.
I'll take the second part of that question first, because I think it kind of leads into the first part of it. I think the question for me in sort of dealing with the books as it comes to reviewing the show is I mostly read about TV. It's not just for fans of the books. It's for kind of viewers more generally. And it's tough from sort of a critical perspective. I mean, like, I don't even look at this from a business side. I don't get paid to do this. I don't have to serve a certain audience. But it's weird to me to create a form of criticism that is only for certain people who watch a TV show. That's weird to me. To me, you want something that can be engaged with from different perspectives, from sort of these different angles. And so as a critic, I sort of decided I was going to take that as my perspective, which is I am both a critic of television and someone who has read the books and therefore has a certain relationship with this. And so this season in particular, I found there's been a few moments, particularly with, say, Theon's storyline, where it's like I am definitely reading it as a book reader. I can't not. Like, you can't turn off that side of your brain that knows what's going on, that knows what's happening. But I also kind of want to distance myself from that and say, okay, how is this actually working as a television storyline if I right. didn't have that information? And I think I've had some conversations with other critics who are in that position. And when I wrote about it at the start of the season, I sort of said, you know, I'm not sure how this is going to play to non-readers, given that how much of my experience with it is being foregrounded on my experience with the books. And the reality is, I think it holds up fine. I think the season's been good. I don't know if I'm willing to say it's been spectacular. I'm not sure if that's where my relationship with it is at this point. And certainly, that can change as the season comes together in the next couple of weeks. But what I think really stuck out to me was there were points this season where I couldn't help but read it as an adaptation. And I don't like to do that. I don't like to think of it as, oh, they're changing this or doing that or playing through that game. I want to take it on its own merit. I want to try to do that. But there's some storylines this season that have been tougher to do that. And maybe it's just that the Red Wedding hangs over everything as they're building to this point. How are they building to it? All of that. But it definitely feels like that has been more foregrounded this year than, say, last year, where there weren't quite those big moments of adaptation to sort of complicate things. So I've definitely found my experience to be almost abstract in how I've approached the season. And I'm sort of interested in how other readers have navigated that same space.
Yeah, and I agree in terms of, on the one hand, the book readers who are also show watchers get a lot of crap for being overly critical of any change from the books they so treasure. But on the other hand, I think we book readers are also more forgiving of holes in the plot that we can just sort of spackle in with our knowledge, you know? So it's this weird push and pull where little details or changes will annoy you, but then like you have this glossing over of, I already understand. So when show watchers are frustrated by like the Theon plot line, I completely get it because it's irritating, and it's going to be irritating to them when it's revealed because it's not going to be anything that's going to blow their socks off. So it's just, it was weirdly done. I don't want to, like, you know, Monday morning quarterback Weiss and Benioff, but, like, I would almost rather that Theon wasn't in this season or we had had one scene, you know, rather than, no offense to Alfie Allen's performance, which is great. And the kid from The Misfits who's playing Ramsay, like, great, you know, great performances, but the way it keeps cropping up is frustrating to other people, and then that frustrates me as a fan because I'm like, oh, well, just wait, but still you won't be happy even then. So
I had one person talk to me about it. I'm just like, it will pay off. Like, they are doing something. Like, there is a reveal central to this that he is Ramsay and that we're going to play this sort of game. It's like all of that's there, but it is sort of like they would need to turn that into this momentous moment. I don't think it can be.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they would need to really transform that, and it's sort of like, a lot of it is, okay, things could happen, right? Things could happen and really put that into perspective. But it's like, at the same time, I think you're right. It's not, I don't think you could go an entire season without seeing Theon.
Right.
I don't think you could do it just in terms of narrative flow. I don't think TV works that way. And I don't think trying to tell that story retroactively later on would have worked. I think Theon and the whole torture storyline has drawn out certain parallels with Jaime that have occasionally been productive. The challenge for me is, how often it has recurred and how much time we've spent on it relative to how important it is.
Right.
And the problem with that is that, going to your point, we as book readers know how important or not important something is, or at least we think we know. Right?
Right.
We have our impression of how we are hierarchizing these storylines. The thing with new viewers is they're doing that on the fly. And so for them, this is not just like not matching up to something. It's not actually doing anything. It's not functioning in the way it's supposed to function. And so there is this sort of thing, going to your point, as a book reader, you need to do two things simultaneously. I think we need to avoid the knee-jerk, oh, this isn't like the books, it's terrible response.
Right.
Which is part of the reason why I don't like thinking in those terms, because it's natural to have that response. And sometimes I want to push back against it to say it's doing something different, it's doing something there, etc. But at the same time, we also need to be in some ways more critical of the show than we would be otherwise, because there are things that we do fill in, as you know, that others don't. So, like, it's, I find it fascinating, but it's also inherently frustrating in that we feel like we are turning off one natural response, and then if we really want to be quote unquote objective, we can't actually be objective, but like, to invest objectivity into the occasion, we almost need to like try to shut off the book reader point to view it from a different lens entirely. And that's a complicating process, and it results in a lot of divergent conversations, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion that, while productive, does sort of place like, what is the show doing, into this sort of weird liminal space.
And I think what it has created, which is so odd, is a large group of people who like to watch the show, not read the book, like to watch the show, like to talk to someone who's read the books to get help filling in some of those gaps, but also likes to be guarded against spoilers. It's this really, like, it's not just on our podcast. Like, I see it all over the place where people have a spouse or a friend who they can be like, okay, I don't understand. What is this? But don't really tell me. Just kind of sort of half tell me and protect me from the spoilers. And it's so, the Theon plotline has been the most annoying spoiler, because you've got all these book readers who are like, the show's making it obvious because the flayed man banners are there and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, first of all, no, it's not obvious if you don't know what you're looking for. But secondly, like, I have never thrown myself on so many like spoiler grenades for like I will protect people all day long from the Red Wedding information. But like the Theon information, it feels so stupid. I'm like, it doesn't matter, but I'm going to try really hard to like, preserve your innocence, but it doesn't matter. But the Red Wedding, like, that matters. So I will try very hard, you know?
And that's the thing is, we, for some bizarre reason, treat those as similar.
Right.
When they're not.
No.
Like, the fact that he's Ramsay will not reinvest any meaning into what we just saw. I know at least a few people. I know David Sims of the AV Club has put it together.
I mean, it is.
And the flayed man's there. Like, it's all, there is so, the iconography, if you're analyzing this closely, is there. But the challenge of the show is that, like, the kind of close viewing that inspires theories, that inspires all those different ideas, is something that's tough to do with Game of Thrones without falling into spoilers.
Right.
Like, if you want to be someone who really analyzes this show and dives into it, you don't really have that many safe spaces in which to do so. And so you want someone to talk to, and you know someone you can talk to, but if you're someone who really invests themselves in television in this way, you're also probably someone who'd read the books.
One would think, and yet there are people who are, like, so into the show but don't want spoilers, and it must be impossible. Like, and someone, I was talking to someone, and they knew about the Red Wedding, but they knew nothing about the Red Wedding, just episode 9 Red Wedding is all they knew. And that alone, like, you know, that's too bad, because, or even that we've all talked about something's coming in episode 9, you know, because then they'll, like, they'll see the scene of the wedding, and they'll sort of get this, not the same shock that we book readers got when it came out of nowhere, you know?
Can we recreate that?
No. I mean, you can't.
But we want to. Like, right. And that's the thing is, like, as much as I'm sure we all have different standards for it. The whole spoiler conversation is so much larger and so much more complicated, particularly in this case where it's just off the wall. But the thing that always drives me is, like, I don't want someone else to have my exact experience, but I want them to have whatever their experience wanted to be. Like, how do they want to go into this? So when someone asks me, like, I had someone at one point ask me if I could direct them to the chapter in A Story of Swords that includes the Red Wedding, because they knew about the Red Wedding. They didn't know what it involved, but they wanted to read it for themselves instead of having it spoilered between but not read the whole book. They had read previous books, right, but they hadn't gotten through the third, and they wanted to go into the season without having read it all, but they wanted that moment, having heard the rumors, having heard people say Red Wedding like it's some sort of, like, Beetlejuice phrase that just people keep talking about and spurns into existence. Like, that they wanted that to be pure, to have that experience. And then I get messages back from them saying, like, what the hell just happened? Like, really sort of, like, how did this get set up? How do these sorts of questions? And I'm like, part of what I wanted, at least, was for the Red Wedding and events like that to be able to stand on the merit of how has the show built to them? Because I think that ultimately that was – I'm not, like, saying authorial tenet is the only way to read the show, because obviously there's 15 million different authors who decide what the series means. But ultimately, like, they are trying to set something up, and I kind of want this Red Wedding to stand on its own. But that requires us to eradicate references to a Red Wedding that is so much a part of the fan culture of this book series that we can't do it. We were fighting a losing battle from day one.
It's true. And I mean, it's a very unique cultural, pop cultural interactive experience, you know, and you don't have the same thing with, like, the Dexter series or the True Blood series, where, like, the book spoilers are so important, you know, first of all, because they've gone completely off the map. And secondly, because the fan base is just a different fan base. But, like, for me, the other question is, with these tentpole episodes, these episode nines, like, for the book readers, do we forgive slower episodes, you know, quote unquote boring episodes, because we're so ramped up about episode 9? Like, last year, I think we had you on for, like, episode 7 last year on A Cast of Kings, and Blackwater was episode 9. And you and I both, Dave was, like, complaining about how nothing was going anywhere. And you and I both were like, it's coming. Though it's coming. Episode 9, you know? And then, like, is that fair? Or, like, will people enjoy rewatching, people who haven't read the books, enjoy rewatching the seasons knowing that it has a payoff? Then they can go back and enjoy the scenes where, quote unquote, nothing happens, but it's all setting something up. We're all like, it's important, trust me, you know?
Yeah. So we definitely play that role.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we become almost, I don't know, like, what we are in that relationship, but it is sort of like, you know, oh yeah, just wait. Like, and it is sort of like mirroring that experience where, like, you give someone DVDs for a TV show and they send you an IM. It's just like, I'm not sure about this. It's like The Wire or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, it gets really good really quickly. Like,
you're like, episode 5, just hold on, and then you get there and it'll be great.
And it's like, that's something we always do with TV content. But there's something about this where it's like, it is still new to them. Like, we don't really know that they're going to pull the Red Wedding off.
Right.
Like, we think they will. I think they will. I've seen no evidence to suggest the thing's going to be a complete disaster. Same with Blackwater. Like, we didn't see that in advance, but I think we were right.
Oh, yeah.
I think that paid off a lot of the season. I think it was a big moment that gave them momentum, that reaffirmed things. And so it's sort of like, but in the process, you're sort of right. We're kind of trying to, we are spoiling something in that moment.
Right.
Like, we are. Like, and I think for good reason. I think it can be kind of productive and helpful. But it's definitely this moment where we're sort of like, hey, you know, just sort of give this time. And part of me thinks that just fits with we should always try to evaluate things as entire units and not as, you know, these individual moments. I mean, like, as much as I think episodic criticism is really valuable as a way of sort of marking a response and sort of starting a dialogue and starting that conversation on podcasts and reviews, et cetera, it's also more of a diary of responses than it is a definitive statement about an episode.
Absolutely. And you have to look at its place in the overall tapestry, right?
And so I think for that reason, I think it's – but at the same time, it's like when we know what the rest of the tapestry is – it's sort of like, shouldn't we let other people decide what that looks like, to draw their own tapestry, to kind of like paint their own picture, to not sort of sketch things in because we think we should? It's this really weird gray area where we're not – I don't think we're actually spoiling anything in particular.
Right.
Right? But maybe we're spoiling an experience in the process.
Exactly. And, you know, I agree with you. I have no doubt that The Red Wedding is going to come off beautifully. They've seeded that music cue like so deeply that we all know it. So that's, you know, that's great. And my question for you is, have you heard about the theory about Lady Talisa, the honeypot theory?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that theory?
I definitely think it's one of those things. Look, that's where you start to see what happens when you have a fan culture that has nothing to theorize over. Like, this is a theorizing fan culture, right? The theory is about the, you know, John's parentage and the larger kind of scope of the series. But it's like with the TV show, they don't have as much to work with because they already know what happens. I think the way in which that evolved is very much sort of a part of that culture. Reminds me of sort of the whole point about, like, what do you do with third sons? Well, they go off and fight the Crusades because they have nothing better to do. What do you do with fans who don't have anything to analyze? They go and create this crackpot theory. I think it's a crackpot theory that has a lot of merit. I think as the season has gone on, we've seen Tywin writing a lot of letters.
Right.
We saw Lady Talisa writing a letter. When those scenes came up, I had watched the YouTube video and kind of followed some of that conversation earlier. When that came up, it's sort of like they're definitely leaning into this.
Right.
And I think it's also that question where I think, you know, I make fun of it a little bit, but I think the theorists have a point in this respect of why create this character? Why not just make it the character it was before, tell that same story? I mean, yes, the whole age thing made it more complicated and they had to develop someone new. But the whole idea of Talisa as a character is something they created from whole cloth. And so you have to think there was a reason why.
And what I like to think almost, and this is, you know, outside the realm of possibility, but I like to think that they wanted to do something different so that the book readers who think they know everything, at least they'll have a surprise too, you know.
I definitely think that I would say that's part of it, honestly, because
and that's really fun if that's what they did, you know.
Well, this, like, the whole mystery around that casting, like, it drove people nuts,
right?
It's like, wait a minute, who is this person? Why isn't this the person we expected it to be? How are they being introduced? And I think for a lot of book readers, they were like, this is stupid. Why isn't this the way it was? And I think it's an interesting test of, like, how much are they willing to follow this character. And I think more importantly, how much are they willing to connect with this character?
Yeah, because, and like, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I think the go ahead.
It's my hope that this honeypot theory manifests, because that I think is interesting. Whereas, like, the other option is that they fleshed out this character so that, I don't know, we would have more opportunity for sex scenes between them, or alternatively, because show watchers would understand this idea of falling in love, falling in lust versus the honor bound sort of idea. You know, those are two options. But I always liked that it was a question of honor, because it seemed like such a Ned Stark thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, and that definitely is sort of part of it. The problem is communicating honor is tough.
Yeah.
That's true. I also think you have that question of basically the fact that Rob was a teenager in the books. He was a kid.
Exactly.
And so for him, he wasn't so much doing the honorable thing in so much he was actually doing a dishonorable thing by sleeping with her in the first place, given he was betrothed to another.
Right.
And so he was sort of going back on some honor, but then staying honorable in that moment because he was a kid learning what it meant to be a man and what it meant to have those expectations placed on you. When you make him older, that's tougher to buy.
That's true.
So I think part of the reason Talisa, if going by the theory that this is not actually the whole honeypot circumstance, and in fact, ultimately, they were just fleshing out the character to give the romance more heft so that when they all die tragically, things go wrong. I guess we just spoiled that. But if you're still listening at this point, what are you doing? I think it's the moment where maybe they just wanted to give that relationship a greater sense of sort of adult purpose of why would he make this choice? What would tempt him into making this mistake? What would ultimately doom him to this fate? And the question is, do you want Rob to die someone who made a mistake, who followed love when he should have followed, you know, his mind, and who died for it? Or do you want him to be the victim of an elaborate plot, who fell victim to this sort of notion of temptation, to this sort of complicated structure, as opposed to simply his own failing?
And, you know, in that circumstance, I would have to, of course, say I would rather it not be the honeypot theory, because I would much rather this be about human frailty and foibles than some elaborate no escape plot, you know? So that's a good
point. Tough. It is tough, though. I think it's one of those things where, like, part of me thinks that it pays off a lot of that character development. It turns it also, like you said, it turns it into its own thing. That the Red Wedding here is the same kind of ideas, but sort of picked up more in Tywin's sort of villainy. It plays up his role in this process, his sort of unbeatability, which could then give Tyrion killing him itself in this very simple action more meaning. They certainly played Tywin up more as a character in this show, more as a villain figure. This would help contribute to that. I can see all sorts of logic for the way that works, but I think you're right that it does change the meaning of that interaction for Rob's purposes. And I'm just wondering, how do they want Rob to die? Because, like, of the characters involved in that process, like, Rob's the only one who, quote unquote, dies, right?
Right, because of Catelyn's resurrection.
And so it's like, given that fact, then, like, what do you want the end of Rob's story to be?
Right.
And I'm not sure what they want to do with that. And, like, that to me is why I'm not like, oh, it's the Red Wedding, whatever. It's more like, I want to see the way they play that out. And that's why, like, as much as I do have my skepticism of how much of that theory all falls into place, at the same time, like, I'm glad the theorizing exists, because I think it's turned this into more of a question mark than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, and I mean, it is the kind of enjoyable nitpicking that we love to do with mystery filled shows like Lost or whatever, where you could just like spiral down into Egyptian mythology all day long, you know, for the last couple seasons, trying to figure out what every bit of iconography meant, you know, and because the answer in theory exists out there, as you say, you can't do that with this show, because I mean, you can with like the questions that haven't been answered, like who are Jon Snow's parents, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you're right that this offers us this little thing to obsess over. And of course you could edit the season to reveal whatever you want it to reveal about Talisa, but I really love this theory. And on the one hand, you're right that we would be losing some of that, you know, Greek tragedy sort of storytelling. But on the other hand, I don't know, I think it's still there, where even if Rob was manipulated from the start, he was a young man who lost his heart. And so,
and there is, to be fair, I mean, like, you know, Talisa would probably still have to die in this circumstance. Like, I have to think it would be a sacrificial
environment.
So
I mean, not because I don't like Una Chaplin, because I do, but I think to keep that character around after would be a mistake. Either way, you know what I mean? Like, if she's innocent or if she's not, I know that there's, you know, Jane Westerling is out there in the book, but like, I just think they need to tie up that story.
Yeah, I think she needs to go.
The storyline that diverges from the plot that I don't mind, the book plot that I don't mind at all, is the way that they've folded Gendry into the Dragonstone story. I like that. I thought it was efficient for them to be like, we already have a bastard, Robert Baratheon, that all the show watchers know who it is. Like, why introduce a new character when we can recycle this one who's pretty popular? So,
and who also kind of just sort of like goes off into the woods in the book.
Exactly.
Right? Like, yeah. And it's one of those things where, like, this is where I have to imagine the conversations they've had with George R. R. Martin.
Right.
Which
where they're
like,
is this okay? Can we steal Gendry right here?
Yeah, like, what's your plan for Gendry?
Yeah.
What's up with Gendry? And it's like, he's sort of like, well, and he just hesitates for a second. And they're like, okay, we're good. Like, I can just sort of like imagine, like, those are conversations that have to happen.
Exactly.
In which they make a plan with a character that still exists in the books, that's out there. And they're like, how important is that run-in with Brienne?
Yeah.
Right? Like, how important are those different moments? And it's like, I'll be honest, like, going to my point of not paying too much attention to the books, like, when they did this storyline, I immediately, like, went to the wiki, and which is sort of like, what happened to Gendry? I knew it, like, wasn't, I know he didn't die, I knew he was sort of out there, but I'm like, what really went down? And I read it, and I'm like, I can see why they thought that worked.
Exactly.
And I agree. Also, again, going to that point, as a book reader reading the show in those terms, it was a really enjoyable little secret. That
exactly.
would get to be revealed to us and sort of say, wait a minute, okay, why is Melisandre there? Why is Gendry involved? And as soon as he was involved, it made perfect sense.
Right, exactly.
Right? Like, it fit into place where it's like, I didn't find, I'm like, what is going to happen now? It was that moment of, like, realization of, oh, I see what they're doing with this. They're using him instead of Edric. And it's like, and it really fit together. I didn't question it. I didn't, like, start saying, oh, I'm not sure how this is going to work. I'm like, no, that is, like, going to your point, efficient.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of, that's the right kind of change to make in those circumstances.
Exactly. And so then on the flip side of that, I will say that what they did with Sam, I don't really like, because they saved his bravest moment for this last episode.
Yeah.
And that's too bad because, well, I'm just tired of a lot of people who just watch the show and don't read the book calling Sam useless. And it makes me really sad and defensive of him.
Yeah.
And I just feel like they've painted him as this craven idiot and, or not idiot, a clever, but craven. And he, I think he's so much more in the book. And not that he's the best character in the book, of course not. But I just feel like he's not getting his fair shakes in the show. And it's disappointing to me. So
the craven with the ravens?
There you go.
No, I think it's one of those circumstances where I think you're right. I think ultimately they made a clear choice. And, like, I knew, like, at the very beginning, everyone's like, what happened with Sam the Slayer? Why isn't that there? Why didn't this take place? And part of me was just sort of like, I think they want to make that into more of a kind of less of a actual, like, circumstantial, like, he's in the middle of a battle and something happens, and more like a character beat for him. And I, on paper, like that idea. And at the time, I'm like, look, he's still going to do this. He's still going to take on this role. They're going to leave the Dragon Glass in, and there it was, and things happen. But the problem is he didn't do anything between then and now.
Right.
Right?
Except
like, he went to Gilly, kind
and,
of,
yeah,
he kind of, like, you know, happenstancely kind of brought her along. We got some insights into his character, but there was none of that. Like, part of the book was that he gained confidence from that first moment
right.
that he was able to use to drive the rest of his engagement.
Exactly. And so instead of the growth, the steady growth, you get
yeah.
just one interaction where it could be just, you know, blind panic or bravery or what have you. But
and it's like, we still need to see how they, like, pivot out of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
we're
what
not,
is Sam like after this? Like, and I think that can still work, but I think it's this question of their argument, I think, was that this was meant to be the culmination of his development, that he's gained bravery through assisting Gilly, through getting out of these circumstances, to finally being alone, to kind of, like, withering all those insults and then moving back and taking this moment. But the way it played out in terms of the blocking was just panic to me.
Yeah,
like, I
exactly.
didn't feel it was him really sort of, like, owning that sense of things. I think him with the sword, sort of, like, there was this moment of, like, panic and terror. I guess I wanted a little bit less, like, I think the blocking could have been better to communicate what I felt they were doing with the storyline. As it stood, it just felt like a climax. Not to his story, but to the episode.
Yeah, and then he goes and leaves the obsidian dagger behind intact. And so everyone's just like, all right, well, you're stupid again. And, you know, it's just like, no. Sam.
We don't know they're not going to go back. Like, the Sam. Next episode could start with him stepping back. Like, I definitely think it's one of those circumstances where, going to your point, sometimes we're like, okay, just wait for the next episode. Wait for that to happen. Other times we read what they're saying about characters and we're just like, oh, you have it all wrong.
Yeah. You
and
don't understand.
Yeah. You don't understand. What are you talking about? You know, think about it this way. And I think the challenge with that is finding that sense of, are we responding to just what's on the screen?
Like, and we're not.
We,
I mean, as book readers,
we're not.
Yeah, we're not.
And the thing, like, but that being said, I do think there are times when I look at what people are saying about a character like Sansa, and it's sort of like, I don't think my response to some of the really sort of dismissive approaches to Sansa are just about the books, because frankly I don't think she's that complicated in the books. I don't think it's the case. I think the show portrayal is actually in some ways a little bit more kind of giving her this sense of sort of tragedy around that character, using her as this key piece in the King's Landing setup that has evolved so much from where it was demonstrated in the books as the different point of view characters expand in all these different directions. And so I'm like, I think anybody who dismisses Sansa entirely entirely from the show, based exclusively on the show, is still doing the character disservice, but I can't lie and say, oh, yeah, no, the books had nothing to do with that. Nothing at all. They do.
Right, right.
Inevitably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking to that, there's the whole Jon Snow situation where I feel like, as book readers, we're infusing Kit Harington's performance with a lot more than is actually there. And I think a lot of people are not seeing the internal struggle that I feel was portrayed so well in the books and has not been done as well in the show. And so I think a lot of people don't really buy John as one of our heroes that we're supposed to be rooting for, because I think Kit Harington's performance has been a little weak, with the exception of this last week. It was like maybe one of my first times in a while that I've seen him really act. But I mean, would you agree with that or do you disagree? Do you have a different perception of the show, Jon Snow? I mean,
I would tend to agree on Harington's performance. I don't think it's bad. I just think it's not. It is in this weird position where the way they've chosen to portray Jon Snow is a little bit, we miss being in John's head.
Right, exactly.
Like, that's what I think is happening there. And I think it would be very tough. How do you kind of portray that in a space where John is sort of constantly, particularly once he joins the Wildlings, when he was with the Night's Watch, you had his interactions with Sam, you had his interactions with Mormont, some chance to sort of like play out those kind of different dynamics. And I felt like we got a bit more of the dimension of the character of what is his fate, what is his relationship with his family, what are some of those dynamics, etc. When I think you look out to the Wildlings, though, the whole challenge is that he can't really be honest with any of them. Right.
Right, so he's performing.
We can't see his pain. He's performing a blankness.
Right.
Because he needs to, because he can't be all in with them. He's undercover. And to be fair, with Ygritte, he has this sort of complicated relationship in that he wants to be intimate with her. He doesn't know if he can. He's a little bit more playful, but he still is sort of like walking this fine line. And it's sort of like, I think because we are not in his head, because we don't get a chance to sort of talk to him or interact with him or really get any further insight into that sort of challenge, it does end up feeling like this blank slate. And I think it does sort of it's kind of dull. And I think all of the John stuff this season has felt like it lacks. We kind of know where they're going, but I'm not sure why it matters. They don't really represent a huge threat, but we don't have what's happening at Castle Black to contrast with it. And there's no sense of that sort of convergence that you get in other instances. And I think part of that is because, like, they're not going to get to Castle Black this season.
I know.
Like, they
can't. Exactly.
Like, so it's sort of like they literally are moving from point A to point B, and they're not going to get to point B this season.
Well, but then the question again becomes, do we have to check in with John and the Wildlings every episode then? Do you know, like, could we?
Because they are, right? Like, are treating Beyond the Wall and John as one of these central threads. And I think in part it's because they know in the future that what's happening beyond the wall is going to connect in with Stannis. It's going to become a more larger part of the story. And part of the show's kind of point is that while all the other characters are dealing with their own political struggles, there are these things happening outside of Westeros, beyond the wall, in Yunkai. Those events are really more meaningful and more of a threat than anything that Robb Stark or Tywin Lannister is going to do. And so they want to keep those active, but you're right, all they're doing is keeping them active.
And just like with Dany last year in Carth, it's like, we don't need to check in with her as often as we did. We wouldn't forget, you know, like, you know, you can't not show Theon for the whole season, but if you show him a couple times, or if you show Jon most every episode, you know, like, that would just, I think, imbue it with more import than they're walking again in the snow. Okay, they've climbed over the wall. Okay, now they're walking on the other side of the wall. I mean,
yeah.
And as you say, they're spreading shit out in a way. I don't know. That's interesting to me. I think because book four is so notoriously dry, I'm hoping that they really condense that book seasons wise. And I'm not sure how they're intending to spread out the next few seasons, but I know that, you know, like, in theory, the back half of book three is supposed to be next season, but I'm hoping they draw in some of book four into there as well.
And I would also say, like, I mean, the Red Wedding is not quite the halfway point of book three.
Exactly. It's
right?
two-thirds.
It's basically two-thirds.
Yeah.
And certainly in treating this as sort of like this transition point, I think we could sort of start to see ways in which the end of book three can still function as – I think the end of book three could still function as an end to season four, theoretically, right? Like treating that whole situation with Stannis as being a kind of finalizing point of that season. But at the same time, part of me is like, that's too long. You'd have to move so much of book four in. You'd have to fill in so many gaps. You have to move so many different things around. And so it's sort of like the challenge of, it's a book of two climaxes.
Right.
Right? In the fact that you have Tyrion and Tywin, you have Stannis on the wall, you have those different elements that are still sitting there that you have to believe they consider those to be major events need to be built around. But like, because of the way the seasons are breaking down, does next season need to avoid treating those as cliffhangers and as climaxes and by building them into episode 9, episode 8 in that sort of range? Or do they need to deliver on them in the middle of the season and then use that as sort of less of this like gradual narrative buildup where they put the pieces into place and move things around and then deliver the big moment, let it have the denouement, and then move on to the next pattern? They have a very clear pattern in how they've been telling these stories, and I wonder at what point, going to your kind of your case with the books, at what point do they have to abandon that in order to tell this story?
Yeah, you know, like with a Purple Wedding, if that doesn't happen early in next season, I would be very surprised.
Yeah, like that to me, that sort of has to
right.
be. So given that fact, like, and that's also sort of a natural climax.
Right.
To some degree, like we kind of need to get that moment. So in that case, then, are we looking at a structure that's less built around like everything building to one thing and more about all these sort of separate climaxes exploding like every three episodes?
Well, I mean, we did have the Astapor sequence with Dany in episode 4, I think it was this season. So, you know, I think they do leave room for an earlier mini climax. And then, but yeah, I don't.
What I think going to that point is the idea of mini climaxes, the idea that different stories are working on different like timing patterns, like different pacing patterns. So Dany is probably not going to have a huge climax at the end of this season, but she had her like the Astapor sequence was her big climax.
Right. She had her
and
moment.
You'd argue that that was the climax to all the Carve stuff to some degree. Right. So it's this idea that maybe if you kind of separate those out, you might have that one big moment that pulls everything together. Let's say it's Stannis on the wall. So how they're going to fill 8 more episodes of Stannis, I don't know. But anyway,
he's another character that I think a lot of people have had, show watchers have had trouble with. And we were talking about this last week on the show, where I don't think it's a fault of Stephen Delane's performance at all. I just think Stannis is a really inscrutable character. Yep. He's the reason why you have to have a Davos, because he's such Davos, like, humanizes him and is your touchstone to Stannis. But Stannis alone is like, you know, I think Delane is doing a great job with him, but he's just like a very unapproachable character, you know?
And,
so.
And the whole point of that arc is really kind of giving him purpose, in which he chooses to make this move that saves a character that maybe the viewers don't care as much about John, but then ultimately, like, there's a sense of things happening there that he's sort of being a part of. He gets brought into more his ability to interact with more characters is meaningful.
Yes.
Right? Like, that's the kind of thing where, like, even bringing Gendry into that circumstance, right, of, you know, Davos being, I think, Liam Cunningham has been really great. And I think so. I think it can work, but it's still sort of like, if you need to wait to get to that point, you're basically like giving them 4 episodes of setup, them disappearing for those episodes, which is what the books do. They let you forget about Stannis, and then all of a sudden he turns up.
Right. Which is great, because then you're surprised. Yeah.
So maybe they can sort of pull that off, treat that as the big climax, but then deliver the Purple Wedding like at like episode 4. Like treating maybe we're due for episode 4 climaxes at this point.
Yeah. You know, like, and
that's
I think
the way you tell the story.
I think you need that. Otherwise, all the backstory that is needed for the satisfying payoffs, like, you cannot do eight dry episodes of that. And I don't think they ever do. I mean, they throw bears in there, like, you know, people when people say nothing happens in an episode, I'm like, well, they fought a bear, so I don't know what to tell you. but that happens. And well, so speaking of the Brienne and Jamie stuff, which I think has been the thing about this season that has worked the best, and it's the plot that, in my opinion, adheres closest to the book. And so I'm not saying everything should, obviously I'm not a purist, but I do like that they just let this plot breathe the way it does in the book, and the performances are so good. And once again, you know, you said we miss being inside Jon Snow's head, and we do. And thankfully, like, Jaime has Bran to talk to, so we get these monologues about what's going inside his head. But I also think the performance by Nikolai Coster-Waldau is so much stronger, that a lot of that internal development that we love in the Jaime point of view chapters in the book, or I loved anyway, is playing out so well because of that twin performance slash, you know, the monologues that we get. So
yeah, and not only does he have someone to talk to, but he also has a sense of humor.
Yes,
like, it's like, and I think that's the thing where, like, John doesn't, like, that's not John's character. Like, even when we're inside his head, he's not this, like, really sort of, and, like, the thing is that we got that with John early on, but it's sort of like the character had to die inside.
Yeah.
In order to function, he had to become the sort of tabula rasa. And so when I start sort of thinking about, like, that character, and I think about Jaime by comparison, Jaime is a talkative person by nature. He talks through things. He's kind of very kind of, you know, playful and casual. But then talking is what ultimately gets him in trouble. Like, he talks his way into losing his hand. But then once he loses his hand, who is he but his charm? And, like, that's why, to me, like, the characterization that they've chosen and developed have been consistently, as they've played out the loss of his hand and the loss of his identity, has played into a lot of who that character is, what it means, and the idea, like, him attempting to save Brienne with one hand was never going to go well, right, from that perspective. But the idea is that he was still able to save her by nature of him wanting to, and by sort of putting himself in that position. That plays into where his arc is going to go from this point forward. That's certainly the thing that'll work best in the fourth season, is letting that character kind of, like, re-explore his life in King's Landing, using that as sort of this kind of central point. Like, there are a lot of really, I think, great things that can happen in that storyline for both characters involved that I think really is a testament to the work they did with those characters that was not all in the book.
Right, exactly.
Like, I think we got more of Jaime. I think we got more of Brienne. I think we got a really sort of well-drawn sort of, you know, gradual process. And I think part of the challenge for show viewers and to some degree book readers is, like, well, why couldn't every storyline be that way? Like, why couldn't they develop that kind of dynamic for, you know, Robin Talisa or for Catelyn, who sort of just sort of, like, been, like, filtering off into the universe? And I think, honestly, it's the fact that part of it, at the very least, is the fact that, like, some of these they're clearly drawing on the overall arcs of some of these characters. Like, I think that Jaime's character arc is very much driven based on where he ended up evolving to in the books.
Right.
In a way that his role in these early books wasn't. And so I think that's been given more meaning and more purpose, whereas, like, Rob's about to die. Who really cares?
Well, no, I actually thought that they were trying this season to get us to like Rob and Catelyn a lot more. Like, Catelyn is not the most sympathetic, lovable character in general. And I think they gave her a couple scenes, you know, like the whole Jon Snow speech she had, and then the whole speech at River Run where she's talking about her father. Yep. Like, I thought they were trying to get us to like her just before they kill her.
Well, but at the same time, they're speeches, right? Like, they feel like speeches. Like, they feel like monologues that have been crafted. I think there was like, J.C. Jacob really hated that Jon Snow piece, and I'm like, I thought that was really consistent with the character that I understand. I think it fits with her sense of guilt and her, you know, her sense of loss with her children and how she feels responsible but also separated from them. And I'm like, there's a story to be told there, but they only seem to tell it when they, like, really said, oh man, we need a Catelyn scene here.
Right.
Right? And that's where it's sort of like, I never felt that way with Jaime and Brienne. Right? No, I never felt like, they're just dropping in, we need a scene here to do this. And
that felt very organic.
Yeah, and that's where I think that sense of organic storytelling is tough when you're piecing together so many different things. Like, it's never all going to feel organic, but at the same time, when parts of it feel so organic, you look at the other parts and say, why can't you be more like that part? Like, where
what's
did
wrong
you fail
you?
Here? Come on.
Well, speaking of, I think probably the weakest part, and unsurprising even as a book reader, is the Bran scenes. Because you can't incorporate the dream sequences in the same way that the book does. It's just, it's not quite filmable. And I'm surprised that they've done as much as they have with the dreams. That being said, it's not working. Like, every time we check in with them, I think, you know, you're just sort of like, oh, okay. And, you know, once again, that's no slight. I really like the young actors who are playing Jojen and Mira, but it's just the check, the constant checking in with them. It's like, okay, they're still camping. Oh, let's give Osha, let's give Osha a speech. Okay, you know, like blah blah blah. Like it's
hoarder,
just...
hoarder, hoarder.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and I think that's the thing. It's like just going to that point. Do you know what it's like? It's like when your session on a website, like a secure website, is about to run out.
Yeah.
And like that little message pops up on the screen of like, do you want to extend your session? That's what they're doing. Like they're just extending their session in enabling that they don't like disappear entirely from the minds of viewers.
It's like, and, you guys, Rickon's still alive. He may not have any lines ever.
But there he is.
He is alive. There are still some dire wolves going on. They're there. Do you see
and
them?
What's weird is that like there are some, like they haven't split them up yet. They're technically, they have them on a very interesting trajectory if we like read a whole lot into those scenes. But like we're getting nothing from it. Like, there's nothing to sort of take from it. And yet, and yes, I mean, like, they're heading towards what is meant to be this, you know, brief sort of drive-by with Jon Snow. I realize they're using that as kind of their central case. The direwolves certainly play a role. I think the direwolves have been – I've liked the way they've sort of used them as, like, presences but not really active ones. I think it's all generally worked. Like, there's nothing going on in this sort of, like, sequence that I think has been actively bad. It's just been nothing.
Yeah. Which is sort of how it feels in the books, too. I mean, unless you're really into the dream aspect of it.
Like,
you know?
To be fair, like, that's the thing where, again, it's like, I don't know what the solution is. Because it's not like you can make Bran that much more of an exciting character when, no offense, but he is a cripple. Like, you can't, like, dramatically change where he is in the story, how much action he can take. The dream sequences, they're doing them because they're the only thing to distinguish the character.
Exactly.
In any major way. Like, and so it's like, it's really it's a losing battle that they're fighting. And it's, again, sort of that sense of they're checking in, not enough to make it more substantial than it is in the books, but also too often to make it seem like he is sort of being treated as a marginal figure. It's like they want to make him seem central, but they have no case to make.
My favorite Bran chapter in the book of Storm of Swords is the one where Mira tells the story of the Knight of the Laughing Tree, that whole, the tourney at Harrenhal. It's this really, you know, it's one of those typical George R. R. Martin, like J.R. Tolkien, like backstory sequences where you're just like, let's get into this long story. And it's, and it's told so beautifully, and they'll never do it in the TV show, of course, unless like people are naked in a tub together and telling it to each other. But like, it makes me so sad because I'm like, it was so lovely to read in the book. They'll never be able to pull it off in the show. The show watchers will never get that story. And does it matter? Maybe not. But it's like, it's that richness. And that's why when people are like, well, why should I even bother read the books? I'm like, I feel like you can be a huge fan of the show, find nothing lacking in the show, and still be rewarded by reading the books, you know?
Well, and I think, too, it's a sense of, like, I don't know if you've seen the Blu-ray features at all, but they have those histories.
Yes, yeah.
That they do. And, like, to me, you could have Mira read one of, like, that story. Right? You could give that little moment where it's like this sort of ancillary content where if you really want to go look at it, you can get her telling parts of that story. You get some kind of attractive art to go with it and sort of move through it. But it's this sense of if you want to give those scenes meaning, they have so far been unwilling to make them more substantial and allowing that to play this larger thematic or simply sort of like world building process.
I almost wanted like a Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows sequence, as you say, attractive art. Like I wanted her to tell the whole story with some like beautiful animation to it or something like that. Like that's what I wanted. But no, they're just keeping the camping parts from Harry Potter and not the storytelling parts.
Until you get to the dance in the tent, those sequences in Harry Potter. And I think it's this challenge though of like, I don't know how much I... There, it's sort of like, yeah, they were kind of screwed. Like, they were never going to make that work. I don't think they're bastardizing it. I don't think they're destroying it. I think it's consistent with the way they've adapted it in the past. But you're right that it is that sort of moment of, you know, if they were going to keep Bran in, like, I want them to have a reason to do it.
Right.
And I think that's
once again, maybe they do. Like, in The Ineffable, we don't know what George R. R. Martin has planned. Like, maybe it is very important, you know, and we don't know. Yes.
But at the same time, with Bran, I will say, like, we definitely don't know. Because if there's been anything in those books that have justified Bran's continued existence in that story, other than, like, keeping up some, like, but like they keep moving him around and doing stuff. Like, even the books, I would argue, have yet to make that point.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. It's like I kind of feel like, oh, it's fine to cut the Bran stuff. You could have actually killed Bran and Rickon and Winterfell and it wouldn't really matter. But, you know, maybe there's something really exciting that they get to do in book, you know, 6 or whatever. So,
well, I mean, like, you're definitely talking about, you know, everything else happening north of the wall that they're getting into, where they're sending multiple characters. They're still clearly setting things up. Osha and Rickon are still out there, theoretically. Like, there's a bunch of things going on up there that I can understand how they fit in, but the books are always structured like winter is coming, and therefore the north and the south are about to become connected in a more intrinsic way, but it's just taking a really long time for that to happen. And I think part of why they're treating Jon as more central, part of why they're giving more time to that, is wanting to try to sort of build that in up front, but they're not building in a reason for that to be happening.
Right.
And it's like, I think I can read into it. I don't think others can.
I have a question for you in terms of storylines that don't go anywhere. With what is coming up for Dany, or, you know, to be more realistic, what is not coming up for Dany, because it's really boring.
Yes.
Would you rather they go completely off the reservation with her storyline over the next couple seasons to give Emilia Clarke something more interesting to do? Or, like, what do you think the best way to handle the upcoming Dany stuff is?
Lots of dragons. Like, just throw the dragons in every week. It's just like, we can't spend money to fix this thing, but we're just going to put dragons in it, and it will just keep people sustained. I think what works about Dany's storyline over the course of the next few seasons is the idea, like, to be fair, like, I think they seeded it. There was a scene early on with her on the boat where he sort of makes the case of, you know, like, to be a Khaleesi, to have a Khalasar, you need to prove yourself powerful. And in doing so, I thought to the end of the fifth book, which ends with her and the Khalasar coming towards her, her and Drogon, and the idea that the dragon is her representative of that. The dragon has grown enough, become powerful enough, is part of her, that she is now able to reclaim that place that she sort of played at otherwise, right? Yeah. Like, she's a Khaleesi in name only. Her Khalasar is a bunch of people who get seasick.
Right.
like we're not really dealing with this sort of sense of thing.
It's a ragtag little band.
Precisely. Yeah. And so, but like, well, everything that happens between then, there, and now becomes this, like you said, really drawn out, really slow, really kind of lack of progress circumstance. And the challenge is, it becomes sort of like an alternate King's Landing, right? In that you have politics, you have someone sitting on a throne without really doing much with it. You have internal strife, you have advisors, you have a lot of those different dynamics. I think their choice is either to spread out that politics and draw clearer parallels with how King's Landing is working and sort of build it into this other sort of similarity on those ends. So it no longer becomes the same kind of action beat that Dany's storylines have sort of been built around and becomes more like a better version of what they tried to do in Carth.
Right.
Which I think didn't work, and no. I think was a misstep. But I think the idea of it can work if they have the right collection of characters. I think that adding Barristan to that mix is helpful in terms of getting more of a dynamic that they can sort of play into. Missandei has been well drawn. I've liked what they've done with that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I think they could do that, but I still think you run into the expectation that people expect things from Dany and what Dany's storylines represent, and I still think they're going to run into the issue of expectations.
Yeah,
I think execution, they could turn that into something interesting and emphasize some elements of the books without others, but I am not sure if people are going to go for that.
It's hard to live up to season one Dany, which is, I think, the best way her storyline has been plotted over any of the books and any of the seasons. And then season two, Dany was such a disappointment. And then season three, she gets this really cool. I mean, all of her scenes have been really great. Actually.
Yeah, no, I think they've done well to use the momentum of Astapor to invest scenes that are, technically speaking, going nowhere in our minds, because we know it's going nowhere, that are technically, I think, been well drawn and been consistent with her sort of using this new power. So I think they've done a good job with her this season.
Right. I'm just worried what's going to happen in the future. Yeah. But you bring up some good points. I have another question for you, which is that, is there a new character this season that has been your favorite, either because it's the best representation of what you envision in the books or because it's such a delightful departure for you?
I don't know. I mean, Lady Olenna, I think, just sort of has been, like, when they cast Diane Rigg and when you saw those first scenes, like, there's clearly got to be, like, clearly they watched Downton Abbey. Like, they had to have done so. Like, right. I refuse to believe that there's not a whole lot of the Dowager Countess in how they've chosen to render that character, but I don't care.
Right.
Like, it's just one of those characters where, like, you can tell they cast Diana Rigg. It's like, it's a perfect kind of portrayal. It fits who that character is in the context of the books. It brings it to life. It injects humor into a show that can occasionally be humorless. And I think, like, putting in a room with Tywin was over obvious, was a little tired at points, but I'm still like, this is wonderful to watch.
Right.
And I mean,
watching Charles dance and Diana Rigg, yeah, you know, spar, I mean, that's just delightful.
Exactly. And I think that's where one of those characters where, like, it was simple. They didn't overcomplicate it. They didn't try to turn it into something bigger than it was. They let it be this almost cameo-sized performance that I think was really kind of nice in terms of setting up Margaery, of setting up different dynamics, of giving Sansa someone to consult with, of adding another sort of layer to the politics of those different marriages, which will play off when we get closer to the Purple Wedding, which will play into all this. Like, I think it's just been, they haven't overplayed the hand.
Yeah.
And I think that's a danger when you get a performance that's really fun, when you get an actress who's doing a great job, when you get a character who's really sort of rich to play around with, and you sort of just let it be this sort of side part of that story. I think that has been well handled.
For me also, I really like what they did with Thoris of Myr, even though it hasn't been a huge part of the season at all. I don't want it to be a huge part of anything. I just thought Paul Kay did a really good job, yeah, with his performance. I thought they added some elements to that character that weren't there that just made the whole plotline more interesting to me. So,
yeah, I was really going to say, like, the Brotherhood Without Banner stuff was always, it didn't really stick with me from the books.
Right, exactly. And I thought they enhanced it well. And exactly. I mean, it's the Dowager Countess all over at King's Landing. But I mean, how much fun is that? How fun was, yeah, Sansa's wedding? With every single scene with the Tyrell was delightful at the wedding. And Cersei was so fantastic.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, I think they've done a good job of treating that King's Landing stuff as, like, it's not going to be as, like, the dramatic upheaval you saw in the first season, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Ned's time in King's Landing was never going to be recreated. Like, not every season's not going to be this huge, like, you know, up and down, you know, betrayal and those kinds of things. But, like, they're still building to a betrayal.
Right.
And very soon, in fact.
Yeah. And we're enjoying all the political intrigue and, you know, backdoor deals and stuff like that. Back alley deals. What was the other question I wanted to ask you? Oh, okay. So we all know what's coming in episode 9. And it looks like they're not, you know, from what I can tell, it looks like they're not going to just be at the twins. You know, I liked it last year with Blackwater, how they were just at King's Landing. But it feels like that really laser-focused kind of episode they did this week with Sansa's wedding, this last week, yeah, with Sansa's wedding. So I feel like they're going to enjoy cutting back and forth to the wedding, you know, maybe to not give us time to suspect what's going on or whatever, for whatever reason. Bottom line, we know what's happening in episode 9. What do you want to see in episode 10?
I think the weird thing is, I think it's, I want it to be a bit of disarray. Like, I want it, because, I mean, the thing is, like, I think that they can treat the ability to do what you sort of said there is, like, they can treat this like a normal episode, right? Right. And to some degree, I think they sort of laid that groundwork in talking about Sansa's wedding, in which they sort of established, hey, it's tradition for, you know, the men to carry the groom to the wedding,
right,
bed.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
They laid a lot of pipe in terms of figuring out what you want to accomplish so that when we see that wedding going on, like, it's a tradition. Like, we just saw one. I think they played up Sansa's wedding in certain ways and positioned it where they did very much in order to then play the parallel of how this one's supposed to go and how it doesn't. And so what I want is for that to fracture everything.
Yeah.
Like, I want the sort of fracturing of that process in which, you know, people who don't know what's going to happen, like, you know, if you talk to someone like my mother, I don't think she pays enough attention to these questions to know what's going on. For her, similar to Ned's death, this is sort of like, wait a minute, what happens next?
Yeah.
Because it entirely takes the Starks out of the picture. It entirely changes the nature of the war. The War of the Five Kings almost ends. Like, it doesn't entirely, Stannis is still out there, you still get these sort of, you know, the Greyjoy still exists, like, there's still these threats, but, like, the most sustained conflict we have ends. Like, I don't want that to just be, like, here's what's going to happen next season. Like, I want them to sit in that chaos for a bit, because I think that's what we had to do when we read it.
So you want episode 10 to be chaotic fallout?
Yeah. Like, and I think that won't be too hard, but I do think, like, making it so it's not quite this sort of clean ending.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of it to me is that it's not.
So do you want, like, a check-in with every character in episode 10? What the fuck? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, everybody doing it. Yeah. So it's like, cut to everyone getting a raven.
A raven,
it's
yeah.
Like, oh, man, what's going on here? I think for me, I don't know if you need to check in on every character. I think they're going to try.
Yeah.
I think part of them is like, this is now a new world. The game has changed, to play into the title for a moment. And I think for that reason, like, having that sense of, like, what do they do now?
Right.
And, you know, the answer is, like, the answer is complicated. Like, when you think about, like, and the thing is, to me, like, how many of those ending points from the third season do they want to rush to get to this point? Right? Like, because, I mean, like, when you look at what happens with someone like Arya after the wedding, obviously that becomes its whole sort of story. Like, how do you kind of, like, take those ones that are, like, very much, like, this is after the wedding, this is what just happened to them, versus those who are just sort of going on with their daily lives? Like, I just want there to be some contrast.
I know they have to keep the purple wedding for the next season, but I almost wanted initially when the season started, I almost wanted it to be red wedding, then purple wedding, and then ending with Tyrion being dragged off. Like,
yeah,
you know, that was the big, huge, dramatic ending that I wanted that Game of Thrones never does, because episode 10 is always sort of about regaining footing. It's not about, like, another big slam bang finish. So,
but again, like, when are they going to break that pattern?
Right. I knew that it was going to be episode 9. Because it's been episode 9 the last 2 years, and because of the episode title. But even I, like, I wish that I didn't know that it was for certain going to be episode 9 that this was happening.
Yeah, so. And that's the thing. Like, that's the kind of thing where, again, like, I wish I could shut it off.
Right.
Like, I wish I wasn't paying attention. I wish I wasn't working through it. And it's like, and it's one thing to, like, turn off and pretend I don't know about where Theon's going. Because then I can sort of, like, I think there's it's unimportant enough that I can be like, okay, for a moment, blank my mind. I don't know what's happening. How can I analyze this? Because it's Theon. Who really cares? But I think the challenge is with the Red Wedding, you can't turn that off. It has been the one thing that has consistently throughout the entire series' run been on the tip of everyone's tongues. It's been in, like, every, you know, jerk who wants to spoil something just throws in a reference to the Red Wedding and doesn't explain it. And often, I think, because they actually want to be that person
who
plants the seed and then can get picked up. It's like they want – and the thing, like, all of that happening has always used the Red Wedding, which actually makes me ask the question of, like, what are we going to do after that?
I know.
Like,
Purple Wedding.
Like, I don't think we're going to. Like, I think there's a certain inevitability to Joffrey's death.
Right.
Like, the way the character arc.
Oh, I mean, everyone's been waiting for it since season 1.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be this, like, catharsis where, like, almost, like, I don't think people are going to ruin the Purple Wedding for people, because I think they want people to have that moment of catharsis with Joffrey's death. Whereas, like, the moment of surprise of the Red Wedding, people just can't contain themselves.
Yeah.
So it's too much. It is too much. So, like, are we going to feel empty after Sunday?
Yes.
Like, we don't have a secret left.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have that thing that we're holding Trump cards. Over people.
Yeah.
Because at that point, it's like, if people find out other stuff that happens, it's like, Greyjoy is Dorne. Where the fuck is Dorne?
You think Arya's blind, but she's not.
Death will be, in fact, meaningful to her. There is death inside of her. We're going there. Melisandre laid that groundwork.
She sure did. I have one more thing to bring up, because speaking of being surprised, I think a lot of us who are used to not being surprised by Game of Thrones were surprised perhaps by Roz's death and the way that it was portrayed. Like, was that a surprising moment for you? Did you see it coming? Did it feel odd to be surprised by Game of Thrones if you were indeed surprised?
I don't know if I was like... I wasn't, like, on my couch, like, oh, wow, they just did that. I don't want to oversell that point. But I definitely was startled by it.
Right.
And that's partly the image and partly what that image represented narratively. I think it was one of those things where it was a nice bit of misdirection in that they spent some time building her up. They positioned her as potentially taking the role of – they talked about her potentially going to the Eyrie. they talked about all these different things, and it's sort of like, how is Santa going to get to the Erie? Anyway, other things they need to sort of piece together if they're going to bother. We don't know what they're doing with that. But like, it definitely felt like a piece into how that puzzle could work, how they were going to make that sort of happen. And then it was like, oh, they in fact instead turned her into this symbol of the cruelty of this world, a final, really what is, I think, what will be the final statement of Joffrey's terror.
Yeah, I mean,
like in terms of like definitively putting him in that position before the weddings, before that all happens, reaffirming that Margaery has done nothing to reform this boy.
Yeah, exactly. That she can manipulate him to a certain degree, but is not going to be able to eradicate his perversions.
No.
Yeah.
And I think there's something, I thought it was meaningful. I thought it paid off the work they did with Roz. I do think that it fits also into some of the more problematic ways in which they use that character. And I think they didn't quite do enough to entirely reclaim it and to put it back down, while narratively satisfying in some level, becomes a sort of different problematic question. But like, ultimately, it did startle me.
Yeah.
Like that image that I think was meant to startle me, I don't think they looked at that as just like, oh, look, Joffrey's doing some more stuff. Like, I was suitably shocked in a way that, not like, oh, wow, they did this amazing thing, but that the image itself startled me, I think did give that purpose and purchase within the context of the season.
Yeah. And it was a unique experience for me so far, thus far in the show. And who knows who else they might choose to kill, you know, that we aren't expecting. And what's interesting is then you sometimes get book readers complaining that the show has spoiled the books for them because something was left out, or, you know, because something was changed. They're like, oh, I guess that theory that I had about this is not true. If they're not even bothering to put it in the show, it's not going to pay off. So I've heard people, or like when Melisandre was said to Arya, you know, we will meet again or something like that. People who read the books are like, what? They haven't met yet. So that's a spoiler. I'm like, you guys are assholes. Calm down.
And it's one of those things where, again, it's like, I think, and this is such a weird thing, because like, I definitely want people to have passion about the things they love, to be fans. Like, I don't – oftentimes in interacting with people about the show, like, part of me is sitting there thinking, like, are you so much a fan that you cannot disassociate, that you cannot realize that the show will occasionally make different decisions, and that this does not destroy your theories, but rather reminds you that they are theories that you gain pleasure from, not because they're right or wrong, but because they have meaning to you.
Right.
And it's like, I don't want to police how fans associate with something, but part of me always wants to. Like,
I don't want to police it. I just want to say, sweethearts, wouldn't your life be easier if you didn't have palpitations over this?
Well, yeah, that is...
In the most condescending way possible.
however we can make that seem like we're being the biggest jerks imaginable, yeah, that's always our plan. That's always our goal.
That's the tone I strive for, so... You know.
We are striving for glory and shame. Shame in other people that we perform in fact, the most condescending way imaginable.
There you go. Well, is there anything else, spoiler or otherwise, that you want to talk about in terms of Game of Thrones?
I mean, like, I could, as much as I say I don't care, like, I could talk about Theon all day, but it's just sort of, I think it's one of those things where I think it goes to that point of when they're doing things like that, right? When you're making clear choices about a storyline with Theon, it's kind of out of whole cloth. It's not entirely, but in terms of how they wanted to tell that story, right? We can take the decision to tell Theon's story as one thing, and then we can separate that from how they chose to tell it.
Yes.
And I think that's where it's sort of like, oftentimes I think people start going after them for making changes, and I'm like, you can't do that, right? You cannot like go after them and say, how could you change anything? They had to change so many things in the process. But it's like, I think you can sort of go after them for the choices they make within those changes.
Right, or like, or say, this change works for me, this change doesn't, you know?
Of allowing us to have, like, multitudinous responses to change and not responding to the very idea of change.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I completely disagree with anyone who's like, any difference from the book is wrong. Yeah, that's just a naive way to approach storytelling in general, adaptation in general. But I think it is, for me, it's enjoyable to look at which changes work in the medium of the show and narratively, like what preserves my idea of what the overall effect of these plot lines and plot points should be and what doesn't. And of course, different people are going to have different interpretations and different impressions of those different changes. But that's, I mean, I love talking about this as an adaptation in that way, in the way that, like, I embrace some changes, I reject other changes, and on the whole, I like both the books and the TV show enormously, and I just like looking at how they interact with each other, you know?
Yeah, and it's sort of like the challenge of the Theon storyline is that I don't think it's ruining the Theon storyline. If anything, I think it just fits into where that's going, but then you're asking a different question of, is the presence of the Theon storyline, the degree it is, taking away time from other things?
Right.
And that just becomes, again, like, I think a really sort of, you know, complex and meaningful question about the process of adaptation that is not so much a knee-jerk response, but rather an attempt to understand how change in the function of an adaptation has these sort of cascading effects.
Yeah.
And exactly. I think we can often overstate those effects, but I love analyzing them. Cascades are fascinating to me, of like understanding causality and understanding relationships between things, taking sort of the Theon storyline into account. It's like, I think it's done some productive things. I think in terms of raising the kind of specter of torture and sexuality and how we define ourselves and who is Theon as he loses his name, which they haven't really gotten into yet, but it's certainly a huge part of that storyline. Like, I see why they looked at that and thought, I like the meaning of this as tied to other things. I wish they tied it together more effectively. And to me, that is the kind of analysis that, as I'm watching the show, you know, I don't want to just limit it to being for book readers. I know you've done some kind of spoiler stuff, and I'm jealous of that because I think it's a great way to explore this. But, like, I want to have that conversation and treat it not as an indictment, but in fact as a debate, as a conversation like we've been able to have. And like I would hope fans are able to have in the safe spaces where they're able to do so.
Exactly. And like the reason I do like spoiler posts on the website that I do is as an outlet for people so that they can have those spoiler free discussions with other people. But they're like, but I need to say Red Wedding. I need to say it. It's like, it's a tick. I have to say it. I have to type it, you know, that sort of stuff. So to have that area, that safe space where you can be as spoilery as you want to be, and then thus leaving other spaces pristine for other people, you know, and I agree. I like this way of talking about an adaptation where you can talk about, you know, the pros and the cons and not just be stubborn and obstinate about the differences. So,
yeah, but occasionally being stubborn and obstinate, like, I do think we can occasionally have our moments. Like, I just think we need to pick our battles.
Exactly. Because no one's going to listen to you if you say every single change is wrong. But if you say, Sam is not that useless in the book, I swear.
we need our ability to do that. Yeah, like, exactly. I think that I don't want to disenfranchise book readers from being able to occasionally have strong opinions about this. I think as much as we say wait and see to book to viewers, I think we also see wait and see to book readers of don't judge the TV series by its episodes, I guess, is what I'm trying to book in its cover. Things are flowing around in my head as I get through these mixed metaphors. But I do think there's that sort of moment where it's like everybody has to wait and see a little bit, but right. Like everyone also has to like have a space where they can just sort of be like, what the fuck are they doing? Like, I want that to be a response that we can have. I don't want it to be our final response.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Miles, and for letting us get these spoilery discussions out there in the universe. Where else can people find your work on the internet this week?
We just take a brief kind of deep breath. Like, oh, okay, yeah. It's finally out there. It's finally gone. We're ready for the Red Wedding now. We're ready to kind of feel this emptiness. Okay. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/MEMLES. You can also find my writing on Tumblr at milesmcnutt.tumblr.com. And you can also find my work on my blog, Cultural Learnings, and at the AV Club.
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much. This has been almost therapy for me because if you listen to other episodes of the podcast, Dave asks me questions and I'm like literally biting my tongue over here. So it's so nice to just be able to let it all out.
We should get rid of Dave more often.
No.
No, just kidding.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I want to thank Slash Film, as always, for making this show possible and for all you generous donors to our Kickstarter. You can find me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob. You can find me every day on Pajiba.com, or you can follow me weekly at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week to discuss episode 9.
A cat of a different coat, that's all the truth I know. And a coat of gold, a coat of red, a lion still has claws. and mine are long and sharp, my lord, as long and sharp as yours. And so we spoke, and so we spoke, that Lord of Castamere. But now the rings we bore is hard, with no one there to hear. Yes, now the rings we bore is hard, and not a soul to hear. Soul to hear.